The world is burning. Washington, Europe, Canada, even Russia all have wildfires. And it's not just literal wildfires. A conflict that claimed over 500,000 lives may have just erupted into flames again in northeastern Africa. And an explosive drone was found sniffing around one of Europe's most important cargo hubs. We're going to look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Wildfires have been a major story for the whole planet for the last few weeks. We've not talked about them so much on the show, but let's make up for that today. A lot of the worst over the last week have been in the United States. So to get the latest on this, we'll go to our US correspondent, Andrew Miller.
Yeah, it is amazing just to see how many different countries are struggling with this right now, from France to Russia to Canada to many different states in the United States. And here in the U.S., wildfires have actually been a rising trend, becoming more common than they used to be for three separate reasons. One being the U.S. Forest Service doesn't clear away the underbrush in ways that they used to do. They're trying to be more preservationist, letting things grow natural, and just getting a lot more tinder in these areas in the western United States. Two is that large parts of the western United States are in the worst drought of the past 1,200 years. So all the underbrush is extremely dry. And three, one reason that's specifically relevant to the wildfires near Spokane, Washington, is terrorism and arson. The fires currently blazing across Washington are consuming dry underbrush, but they weren't the result of a lightning strike or an accident. There's actually a 37-year-old man, an arsonist named Aaron Ferrasini, who has been arrested and admitted in court that he's just fascinated by wildfires, and he set at least 12 of these. So he's obviously being prosecuted for that, because these dozen or so fires he set, combined with all this dry underbrush in the Washington area, it's burnt over 10,000 acres so far. About 700 structures consumed in flame, and about 67,000 people who've had to evacuate. So massive damage. I haven't seen, and I'm not even sure if it's available yet, like the insurance figures. Like, a lot of these 700 buildings were insured. Usually things like this actually become almost as much of an economic crisis as they are a natural disaster, as insurance premiums go up and these companies just go almost bankrupt trying to rebuild all the buildings they've insured across these areas. So really devastating catastrophe in the Washington area that comes just about a month after we had similar fires, not set by an arsonist, but similar in scope, in Colorado and Utah. And then also in, like I said, across the border in Canada, in like British Columbia and Alberta. Fires that I think have died down a bit, but I remember talking to some people up from that region, just talking about just like the smoke in the air. Even President Trump actually got it on that, criticizing the Canadian government's response to those fires, not doing as good a job at getting them put out, because the smoke was so intense that it actually crossed into the United States and started like deteriorating the air quality in Montana and other places that weren't even on fire at the time.
And a lot of what you mentioned, it's all part of the global crisis as well. I think Europe's had about 500,000 hectares burnt, France 116,000. You had 100,000 people evacuated from Spain. For people in the UK, the biggest impact has been foreign holidays to France and Spain getting cancelled, because we love going to the Mediterranean, and all of these have fires have been springing up. You've had Greek fires on islands and on the mainland. And it's been similar to some of the points you made about arson. I saw one story about in Italy, a bunch of the fires were started by somebody apparently taking their inspiration from Samson. He is, the Book of Judges talks about him tying burning branches to the tails of foxes. Somebody did that with cats and started a bunch of fires in Italy. It's led to speculation that some of these European fires have been started by migrants. I don't know of any evidence to support that, but I also don't know if there's been official statistics about migrant background or the background of arsonists. It's something that it would be good to have authorities look into. 3.6 million hectares have burnt in Russia. I guess it's probably in parts of Russia where not many people live, so we've not heard much about that. So a global problem, and people are talking about the things you identified, Andrew. One thing we're seeing a lot as well, though, is that this is global warming. That the scientists have said we would get worse wildfires. We have a summer of bad wildfires. We have a summer of Italy, Spain, Greece, they have wildfires fairly regularly, but now they're starting to come up north into France, where at least on this scale, we're not used to seeing wildfires as much. So you wrote on this week. What does the fact say? Is this a global warming phenomenon?
No, I think there's two things people need to understand about the scientific cause for this, because whenever you're dealing with climate change and natural disasters, if you're not very educated on the nitty-gritty details of it, you just have a lot of terms being thrown at you that all get conflated. And so first of all is actually addressing the link between global warming and wildfires. We can talk about the evidence for global warming in a minute, but the link between rising temperatures and wildfires is something you need to challenge, because there is good evidence that this year is the third hottest year since human beings started keeping detailed climate records in about 1850. But it's obviously not hot enough that trees are spontaneously combusting. You still needed an arsonist to light things. So the heat wave isn't causing fires to break out. The fires that were caused by other human means like arsonist or just campfires that have got out of control are worse than they'd otherwise be because of the drought. So you basically have a human cause and a divine cause in these Spokane fires. There was a human arsonist, but it's also divine weather curses in the form of drought. And I mentioned briefly earlier that this was probably the worst drought in 1,200 years. That's based off tree ring reconstructions. There's some very old trees in the Western United States, and trees grow faster when there's moisture and they grow slower when there's not. So you can use the tree rings to basically reconstruct pretty accurately soil moisture levels going back a couple thousand years. So from the tree ring data, they figure this is the worst drought in the past 1,200 years, but the second worst drought was in 1600, and the third worst drought was in 800. So obviously, man-made carbon emissions and global warming were not problems in 1600 and 800. There was no industry yet. There was no automobiles yet. And yet the droughts got to similar levels here. So the correlation between drought and temperature, they're just not correlated. There's a different reason for the drought that's making these fires so bad other than global temperatures are high. And so people confuse these, like, oh, because the temperatures are high, there's drought. And it's like the data doesn't support that. There's been droughts almost as bad as the droughts we've had now and far in the past, even before European colonists came to this continent, that also would have created great wildfires. What I wrote on earlier this week is also looking at the science of actual, the heat of the actual global warming, because if there's 2026 is probably the third hottest year since 1850. 2024 was the hottest, 2023 was the second hottest, and 2025 was, I think, probably going to end up being the fourth hottest. So all those years are right next to each other. So you're like, okay, so four of the hottest years of the past 175 years have been just recently. So it is demonstrated that, like, global warming is, like, yes, our data only goes back to 1850, but this is probably the hottest few summers we've had since 1850. Don't have reliable climate records before then. And it is also true that carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas. It does insulate the atmosphere. So it's reasonable to think that man-made carbon emissions are having some effect. Now, I feel where a lot of people make the mistake is that they assume that since the NASA data shows the planet's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit hotter now than it was 175 years ago, that all 2.7 degrees of warming is climate emissions. That's also not true. I mentioned tree rings already. There's also ways that you can use ice cores, tree rings, stalactite levels in caves, to come up with proxies for temperatures in the past. And it's very well established that the planet just naturally goes through about a millennial long heating and cooling cycle. So you had the Bronze Age cold period, the Roman warm period, the Dark Age cold period, medieval warm period, the Little Ice Age happened when George Washington's men were freezing in Valley Forge, and now the modern warm period. I think the first treatise on modern global warming was written by Noah Webster back when the Founding Fathers were still alive, indicating that it seems that the Little Ice Age they were in was ending. So, aside from the greenhouse gas emissions, the planet is naturally going to go into a warmer cycle. So that 2.7 degrees of warming we're seeing, the real scientific debate is not over whether the solar cycles are causing this or greenhouse gases are causing this. It's how much is each contributing. The United Nations, for political reasons, basically comes out and says the natural causes for global warming are basically non-existent. It's all humanity's fault. When really it's an open question. It's probably more like 50-50. So just summing up, it's like the warming we're seeing is a mixture of natural and man-made causes, probably leaning heavier towards the natural causes. That's one point it's important to understand. And the second point to understand is there's no correlation between global warming and drought. Actually, you'd think if there was more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, it would make the planet a little more like a greenhouse. You've got other stories about, like, I don't know, new, like, green growth in the Australian outback that's supposed to be global warming's caused by global warming. So the science, they go back and forth on whether it's drought or whether global warming is making droughts or whether it's actually making the greenhouse gases are making the planet greener. So it's a much more complicated story than the mainstream media is making out, which is important to understand because we've got scriptures that we point to on this program a lot, like Isaiah 29 and verse 6, where God says, you will be punished by the Lord of hosts with thunder and with earthquake and with great noise and storm and the tempest and the flame of devouring fire. So if you believe the Bible, God says that wildfires are one way he corrects mankind for its sins and moral failings. There's other verses in Joel and Amos about I'll send drought on one city and make it floods on another. So that's another one that not only does God correct with fire, he corrects with droughts and he corrects with floods. And in this case, what we're seeing in the United States is the drought is actually exacerbating the fires. Like I said, the Spokane fires were set by an arsonist, but they're much worse because of the drought. And so what our editor-in-chief, Mr. Gerald Flores, has made the point in his article, The Deadly Climate Change Deception, mankind's tendency to ignore the fact that drought and global warming aren't necessarily correlated, and to ignore the natural climate change cycles of the planet, and to say that all natural disasters are the cause of us burning too much gasoline. It's basically, there's not scientific evidence for that, and it basically explains away God's role in history. Saying that, like, we don't need to look at these fires and think, oh, is God trying to get our attention? Are there moral sins and failings that explain why he's not blessing the nation? You ignore all that and be like, we need the government to step in and tax carbon output. And so that's why it's such a deadly deception, is that there's a lot of people that they're not taking any moral lessons from these fires around the world. They're attributing it all to man-made carbon emissions, which, like I said, it just doesn't follow that carbon emissions cause droughts. There's been horrible droughts in human history at a time when carbon was much, much, much lower than it is right now. And even in terms of the heat wave, which it is, it's definitely, my air conditioning bill's hot this summer because I feel like this is a hotter summer than we've had in a while. But the heat wave, like I said, that's partially natural, maybe a little bit man-caused, but that's not even really the worst natural disaster we're feeling right now. The high air conditioning bill is an inconvenience. It's not a nation-destroying curse. It's the droughts that are causing wildfires across continents. That's the main thing God's using to get mankind's attention, or trying to use to get mankind's attention right now.
I mean, it is a message for all mankind. We mentioned it's not just the United States hitting this. This is a problem all over the world. And it's the same with the drought as well as the wildfires. One of the stories we had in our Trumpet morning brief was about the warning to Germany from the Rhine River falling to its lowest level in 145 years of recorded history. And this is of pretty huge economic importance. 300 million tons a year travel along the Rhine. It's Germany's industrial heartland, you know, Dusseldorf, Dortmund, Köln, a lot of these cities, or Cologne, I guess, would be the English name we use for that. But they're all around the Rhine River, the Rhine Valley. And ships, where they can pass at all, are having to carry lighter loads. So you've got more trips, more fuel consumption. People are saying that this could knock a percentage point or a fraction of a percentage point off Germany's GDP. So, okay, like, in terms of natural disasters, well, thankfully no one's being killed by it, but it's a curse and it's a warning that's hitting Germany. And as this little article in our Trumpet Morning Brief points out, some of the warnings about God using the weather to warn mankind are from the Book of Nahum, a book specifically directed at modern Germany. And so we have our own book, Why Natural Disasters, that will take you through a lot of these scriptures and show what the Bible says about God using the weather to warn the world. Forecasts, prophecies that have been proven far more consistently true than anything you've had from scientists and the kind of the media lobby, the global warming, climate change lobby. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. Why natural disasters? In addition to talking about these, how God is behind these events, it also talks about why. You know, why would a loving God allow earthquakes and some of these natural disasters that do end up killing large numbers of people? And it has the answer to something that's a mystery to even a lot of religious leaders. So you can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. We'd be very happy to send that to you, or you can read that online as well. So, Andrew, what else do you have for us from the English-speaking world?
Yeah, three other quick stories. One of them just being like a military curse. There's prophecies in Leviticus 26 about America spending its strength in vain. I feel like the Iran war is a great example of that, where we've been at fighting Iran since February. The IRGC is still in power. We still haven't secured the Strait of Hormuz, and we're now looking for an exit strategy. And it really seems like the only result of this war so far is that we've wasted billions of dollars and are now running out of missiles. A lot of our high-status missiles, according to a Pentagon report, have been depleted. Now, Donald Trump's trying to push back against that and saying that we're fine and we still have missiles. And I don't think we're all out of them. But it is a legitimate point that we've sent many, many high-tech, expensive missiles to Iran, depleting what was our previous inventory of them, and really have seen no good result from it. A couple other stories about political corruption in the United States. One is they've actually got a new FBI report about an operation we didn't know about previously called Operation Oxford Comma. This is a follow-on to the Crossfire Hurricane operation where that's talked about so much in America Under Attack, where the Obama administration, they use this fake dossier that Hillary Clinton paid for to make it look like Donald Trump was colluding with Russia in order to end his presidency. Then Trump found out that FBI Director James Comey knew, even after Trump took the oath of office, knew that the Obama administration was investigating him and was still investigating him, but didn't tell his new boss about the investigation. So Trump understandably fired Comey. That's mentioned prominently in America Under Attack. Now there's this new Oxford comma investigation where they use the fact that Trump fired Comey to open up a new investigation, doubling down on the fact, on the belief that Donald Trump was an active threat to national security working for Vladimir Putin. The Robert Mueller investigation actually looked into that in detail and came out years after the fact that there actually was no evidence that Donald Trump was colluding with Russia. The whole thing was a made-up scandal, but by that point, like, the damage had been done. So just more information on just, like, the level of corruption in the deep state against the man that the American people elected. And then for the last one, we talked quite a bit last week about Dr. Anthony Fauci's testimony, or lack thereof, before the Senate Security Committee, pleading the Fifth Amendment 111 times, refusing to answer any questions about the origins of COVID-19. Senator Rand Paul, since then, this week, has come out and said that Fauci didn't need to plead the Fifth Amendment because a presidential pardon had already insulated him from prosecution. There was no threat to his life or liberty if he just told the truth. And so moved to hold Fauci in contempt of Congress. The Homeland Security Committee in the Senate voted on that this week, and actually did hold him in contempt of Congress. Now, moving forward, the way this works is holding someone in contempt means that he is in contempt of Congress, but Congress only has the power to hold someone in contempt of Congress. They don't have the power to prosecute him for being in contempt of Congress. So this is now going to have to go to the Justice Department to see if Fauci's going to be prosecuted for flatly refusing to answer congressional questions at all. Interesting double standard here in that, if you'll remember back, Trump's trade advisor, Peter Navarro, was subpoenaed to come to Congress to testify about his role in the January 6th protest. He, also believing he might be incriminated, refused to come testify. He didn't just plead the fifth, he actually refused to show up and was held in contempt of Congress, prosecuted by the Justice Department, and sent to jail for a few months. And so there's the Federalist and some other media outlets are basically saying that, like, what Fauci's done is worse than what Navarro did. So if Navarro went to jail for a few months, it holds reason that Fauci should spend some jail time for being in contempt of Congress. I actually don't know enough about the inner workings of that to publicly say on this program whether Fauci should go to jail for pleading the Fifth Amendment or not. But the case has been referred to the Justice Department, so I'm sure we'll all learn more about the inner workings of this process in the weeks ahead.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. I think the big wildfire really sweeping Europe this week is one that we touched on last show, but I think we were only just getting initial reports and didn't have the full picture of the gravity of the situation. And that is this massive breach of the border in Ceuta, Spain's tiny North African enclave. I think at the time I was going off news reports from the night before that talked about 1,500 migrants coming across the border. It was more like 60,000 migrants coming into a little enclave of only about 80,000 people. You're looking at migrants having the same number of people as the regular people living there. You had close to 100 people dying in this crush and sent shockwaves all around Europe. Now, Spain acted fast. It didn't shift the migrants into mainland Spain. They closed all of the shops. There was no food. A lot of migrants went home. That's very different to, say, how Joe Biden operated on the southern border, giving out free phones, putting the migrants on planes and buses, feeding them, etc. A lot of them left. At the same time, a lot didn't leave. I think initially Spain said something like, oh, yeah, no, like 70, 80,000 migrants have gone home, which is an odd figure to give, given that only 60,000 came in. So I guess according to those figures that they released at one point, this was a negative migration. It led to people leaving the enclave. That didn't happen. And since the Spanish government have made those claims, we've had journalists head over there. They've shown, well, you know, there are still a lot of migrants around here. I'm sure thousands did go home, but thousands did not. And as we mentioned briefly, while Europe was waking up to that invasion, you had Italy suspending its free travel arrangements with Spain for a month that it had as part of the Schengen zone. Germany temporarily extended its border checks. It temporarily introduced them all the way back in September 2024. They were finally due to expire, but it extended them. France increased its police presence on its border with Spain fivefold. And this is leading to changes in Europe. You're going to see the rise of a strongman that is going to come and deal with these kind of dangerous situations. And we saw Europe, we saw Germany coming under pressure this week in a different way. You've got fear of immigration and radical Islam as a major major pressure point on Europe. But then also this week, a drone carrying an explosive device, or basically an explosive drone, was discovered at the Leipzig Halle airport. It's one of Europe's biggest cargo hubs. Overnight, it was there between Tuesday and Wednesday. I think what actually, now we know what happened, is some truck driver saw this drone kind of hovering very low around a Ukrainian cargo plane, and he stamped on it. So he alerts authorities. They take a look, and it's like, oh, yeah, you know this drone that you just stamped on? Yeah, there's actually almost a kilogram of Semtex on it. You nearly 2 pounds of Semtex, high explosives. And that, you know, this truck driver just taking action prevented what could have been a much worse incident. Germany's Interior Minister Alexander Dobrindt said that it presents a new level of danger. None of this points to an amateurish approach. We're talking about a professional hybrid threat scenario that we need to continue addressing. Friedrich Merz, the Chancellor, talked about how there was a foreign government behind this. Now, I guess Germany doesn't have evidence of which foreign government, otherwise they would have been even more direct. But everyone is looking at Russia. You've got a drone hovering around a Ukrainian cargo plane. I mean, is Russia sending in explosive drones to German airports? And this is a critical, critical prophecy to watch. This is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry was saying right from when Vladimir Putin first started acting like an autocrat in the early 2000s, that the most important thing to watch from him is the pressure that this is going to have on Europe. Mr. Armstrong talked decades before then about how it's going to be fear of Russia that's going to prompt these European nations to come together. So you've got pressure on Europe to change radically coming from what's going on in the Middle East, these migrants, what's going on from Russia. You're seeing this change. I mean, one small way we're already seeing this change, this is another story from our morning brief this morning, which you can sign up to get the latest stories. You don't have to wait for us to do our end of the week review, but you can get this. You can sign up, have it in your inbox every morning, depending on what time zone you live in, I guess. But from this morning's, Andrew has an article talking about a Roman Catholic priest who went viral calling for a reconquista of Morocco. You know, we needed a Spanish reconquisition of Morocco. I mean, Morocco used to be Catholic. And he pointed out, well, the Arab colonizers that colonized Morocco, we talk about decolonization all the time. Few of those enthusiasts for decolonization talk about the massive Arab colonialism. So he said, yeah, we need to decolonize Morocco and bring it back to Catholicism. Let us finish what Queen Isabel the Catholic left undone, he wrote. And even an archbishop, a very senior archbishop, the president of the Spanish Episcopal Conference, he's also criticized what happened there in Ceuta. So we're seeing Europe push towards being tougher with migrants. It's going to push them towards getting a strong leader, turning to Germany, militarily standing up to Russia and to Islam. And it's this rising Holy Roman Empire, it's also going to have a very Catholic character. You're going to see Europe embrace its Catholic roots as it fights off this Islamist attack. And that's something we just see, just starting with the popularity of just a local priest going viral, calling for that. But Europe is going to respond to these threats from the Middle East. And, well, we had more violence coming very near the Middle East, certainly in the North Africa area this week, that can have far-reaching implications and just also mean a lot of people dying. And to hear about that, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, last Saturday, fighting broke out in Ethiopia in the Tigray region between the government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, a large rebel group that has since stopped the active fighting. But this has been the most significant breach of a ceasefire between the two groups that causes many people to worry that fighting or an active war could break out between the government and the Tigray very soon. The reason this is catching everybody's attention was because the Tigray were the main fighters against the government in Ethiopia's recent civil war between 2020 and 2022. It maybe didn't make the nightly news as much as, say, other crises like Ukraine or Gaza did since then, but by some estimates, the war has claimed over, that old war has claimed over 600,000 casualties. If the upper estimates are correct, it would be the deadliest conflict of this century, with atrocities and war crimes accusations from both sides. Ethiopia is a very populous country, about 110 million people, if my memory serves me right. Any unrest there is going to contribute to more migration problems going on to Europe. It controls the source of the Nile River. It's had a lot of tensions with Egypt because of that. It borders, not directly, it's landlocked, but it's close to the Red Sea, which we've been hearing about a lot lately with the Houthis. So any unrest there could quickly metastasize to affect many other regions.
Metastasize, of course, referring to cancer spreading through the area. This is an area, though, from a prophetic perspective, that we do keep a special eye on. Why is that?
Well, because of a prophecy in Daniel 11, we've been going there quite frequently, where verse 40 speaks of a king of the south provoking World War III with a king of the north. Mr. Fleury has said that the king of the south is anti-Iran and its allies, and the king of the north is United Europe. You can read that in his book, The King of the South. Verses 42 and 43 discuss countries that the king of the north will conquer along with the king of the south, implying these countries are allied with the king of the south. And verse 43 specifically mentions Ethiopia. And because of that, Mr. Fleury has put special attention on what's going on in that part of Africa and some of the neighboring countries like Eritrea, Djibouti, and Iran's attempts to get control of that and turn it into another one of its proxies. Ethiopia is a majority Christian nation. Looking at it on the surface, it may not look like the country that's most likely going to turn into a radical jihadi state, but Iran has incentive on getting control of that Red Sea Mediterranean corridor. You could see that with the Houthis, with Strait of Hormuz, with the other maritime choke points that it is trying to attack the West with. And it is that strategy that Mr. Fleury zeroes in on why Iran's so invested in this part of Africa. Any unrest there, whether from a restart of its civil war or anything else, could give Iran the opening it needs to get its foot in the door and start spreading its influence in that part of Africa.
So an important story to keep an eye on, and not the least just because of the devastation that another conflict could cause. And then even that brings in other second order effects, like another migrant crisis and other implications for Europe. What else do you have for us from the Middle East?
One more story, a breaking one this morning. Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Turkey have announced a mutual defense treaty, which Saudi Arabia and Pakistan have already had that, but they're upgrading to include Turkey into that. And they are spelling out in the official declaration that this is a NATO Article 5 style agreement. An attack on one is an attack against all. We've discussed Saudi Arabia's push for nuclear weapons before on this program. Pakistan already has them, and so does Turkey, on loan from the United States. Saudi Arabia is across the Persian Gulf from Iran. Pakistan borders Iran's east. Turkey borders Iran's west. And so you are seeing these powerful countries, some of which have nuclear weapons already, and directly border Iran, almost creating a net surrounding Iran, purely defensive at this point. But I mentioned the King of the North going after Iran and its allies. Other prophecies like Psalm 83 shows it will use other countries in the Middle East. And Mr. Fleury has said that if you look at the wording of Daniel 11, there's like the Hebrew word there for whirlwind, it implies that Europe is going to attack Iran from all angles. And he speculated that this could very well involve nuclear weapons. And countries like Saudi Arabia, like Turkey, are countries we definitely expect to be a part of Germany's strategy, where Pakistan fits in is a little bit unclear at this point. But you are seeing Iran's shoving around the rest of the Muslim world, trying to assert its influence, its dominance. It is causing a lot of these other powerful countries to band together, which is in line with what we're expecting for Bible prophecy.
Thank you for that, Mihailo. While North Korea has been developing its military at a steady pace as it attempts to, stay independent from South Korea and the West, but also to threaten them. Normally, often when we're talking about Korean missile programs, it's in the context of, well, are they going to be able to launch a nuclear missile? Can they threaten the United States? Can they threaten Japan? Now they're starting to threaten Ukraine as part of their partnership with Russia. To get the latest from this, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. North Korea has deployed a missile unit to Russia this week that will soon be entering Russia's war on Ukraine and helping the Russians to just batter the Ukrainians. This unit is made up of 90 military personnel. They operate 6 missile launchers, and they'll be armed initially with 120 ballistic missiles. So quite a significant amount of firepower that is represented by this North Korean unit. The unit is already in Russia, as I said, and the plan is for them to link up with Russia's 112th Missile Brigade and throw their firepower behind the Russian forces that are currently invading Ukraine. Now, this is very bad news for the Ukrainians. They're extremely short right now on high-end air defenses. Things like Patriot missiles are in dangerously short supply. And Russia's well aware of this, and they've been trying to exploit this shortage by firing more and more ballistic missiles at Ukrainian cities. Ballistics are especially tough to intercept or shoot down unless you have something like a Patriot. So to have this new North Korean unit on the way there with 120 ballistic missiles, unless things change quickly with Ukraine's defenses, we could expect significant numbers of these North Korean missiles to pierce Ukraine's air defenses and strike their targets. And the targets that the Russians generally aim for with these kinds of weapons are usually residential buildings full of people. So it's likely that these missiles will be able to kill and injure a lot of civilians, men, women, and children, kill them or at least blow off their legs or arms. That's Russia's goal, since those kinds of tactics demoralize and kind of terrorize the Ukrainian population. And North Korea, we see that it wants to help Russia in that barbaric goal. So it's terribly bad news for Ukraine, but of course it's very welcome news for Russian President Vladimir Putin and his forces to have another nation joining them, fighting shoulder to shoulder with Russian troops and even bringing in high-end weaponry to add to Russia's arsenals. And this is not the first instance of North Korea directly aiding Putin's forces since this war started 4.5 years ago. Since late 2023, North Korea has been sending huge quantities of artillery and munitions to Russia, and some missiles as well. And then since 2024, North Korea has actually been sending troops. From what we can tell, as many as 16,000 North Koreans have been sent so far to fight alongside the Russians. And so now, on top of all of that, we can add this new ballistic missile unit. So we clearly see that military cooperation between Russia and North Korea is growing. It's getting dramatically deeper and stronger. And this is very significant in the context of biblical prophecy, because prophecy tells us that a huge alliance of Asian nations will soon come together, a military alliance. In scripture, it's called the Kings of the East, and the passages about it make clear that Russia will be the main nation in charge of this, with China in sort of a secondary position of leadership. But these passages also show that this force will include smaller Asian nations, such as North Korea. That's what biblical prophecy tells us. And so for us to be seeing Russia right now waging a brutal war, and to see China backing it up, and to see North Korea even sending weapons and thousands of troops and even advanced weaponry to support it. You can really see the groundwork here being laid for this enormous Asian alliance to come together. You see some of these nations already making war together as allies. So it's very significant. And if anyone would like to understand the biblical passages about this, we have a free booklet that goes through them very carefully and in a detailed way. It's called Russia and China in Prophecy. And that is a booklet that we send out for free. So once again, it's called Russia and China in Prophecy.
Yeah, it's a fascinating shift on this prophetic-based forecast that we've had for a long, long time, that you wouldn't really see Russia and China break with North Korea. Because for decades, you did have people saying, well, kind of North Korea, it exists on sufferance from Russia and China. And you know, they keep bailing them out. They keep doing them favors. The regime there is able to stay in power because of these countries. And they do it to kind of poke the United States and antagonize the United States, keep them away from mainland Asia. But you know, maybe we can find some kind of accommodation. Maybe we can get them to turn against the regime there, ditch them, and then we can unify Korea and we can get rid of a pretty evil regime that way. And so you've had people go and try to talk to China and get them around on side and talk to Russia and try to turn them against it and kind of say, well, look, you know, the costs to you about maintaining this pretty chaotic, unstable regime on your borders could also be pretty high. Now we're in this situation where it's not a case of just Russia continually bailing out North Korea. It's kind of the other way around. North Korea, it seems like they're much more valuable to Russia today than they were 10 years ago. Way more valuable. And so the odds of that alliance crumbling now, well, that's got to have been, you know, that's kind of a distant pipe dream, not something that seems like an attainable goal for diplomats. And so you've seen that alliance that we've long said, well, yeah, this is an important, you know, this is going to stick around. But you see that alliance a lot closer now.
It's a very good point. Yes. And you're right. 5 years ago, I think there would have been some optimism that we could have driven a wedge between Russia and North Korea, or perhaps between China and North Korea. But as you said, that's become kind of a pipe dream with the developments that have happened since then. And North Korea is becoming far more formidable than it ever used to be. It's not only developed a nuclear arsenal, but it's learned how to miniaturize its warheads so that they can be put on missiles. And now it's, as you said, bailing Russia out. You know, Russia didn't expect this war to go on for this long, and they entered into it without adequate weaponry to fight for 4.5 years, but here we are. So they're very grateful to have this ally on their doorstep to be able to work with. And the North Koreans also derive a lot of value from this. In exchange, Russia is giving North Korea lots of technological know-how, even specifically helping their space aspirations and helping them to help their missiles be ever more advanced.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. What else is there from Asia that we should know about from this week?
Yeah, first up, a new white paper from Japan's defense ministry says everything that Japan has been doing to increase its firepower over the last few years is not enough. They point to China's expanding reach into the Pacific, including into areas near Japan, and they say that Japan needs to do more, not just with increased defense spending, but also by shoring up its defense industrial base and by strengthening its various military alliances. So this is just more evidence that Japan and China are locked into a serious rivalry, and that rivalry is driving both powers to build extraordinary military might. But biblical prophecy does tell us that these two will ultimately unite under Russian leadership. So there will be a dramatic change in direction there. And then one final story here about Russia and China working together to enhance their satellite destroying capabilities. A new report in the Indo-Pacific Defense Forum warns that the two are sharing intelligence, orchestrating joint strategies, and investing ever greater sums into their capabilities that can either destroy or disrupt other nations' satellites. And their target is obvious. it's the United States, which has far more satellites in orbit than any other nation. Actually, America has more than the rest of the world combined. And the U.S. depends on these to, you know, just a remarkable degree. And that makes America uniquely vulnerable in space. The U.S. military in particular would be in serious trouble if all of its eyes in the skies were suddenly blinded. And that's exactly what the Russians and Chinese are actively working toward by deepening their collaboration on their satellite destroying and disrupting capabilities.
Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. I wanted to conclude with a positive story from this week's news, one that I think we need to keep in context when we're looking at, say, wildfires and a lot of these negative stories. And this I want to talk about is the new image from the Vera C. Rubin Observatory. This is the observatory with the world's largest digital camera, a 3.2 gigapixel camera. I mean, normally when you're talking about cameras, it'll be in megapixels. Gigapixel is 1,000 megapixels. And they produced their first science-ready public demonstration of this camera just about a week ago. And we got kind of some test images about a year ago, but these are the first kind of proper scientific photos. The picture shows more than 500,000 galaxies in one view. And there's a lot more that is going to potentially come from this. It's focusing on a well-known patch of the southern sky called the Cosmos Field. It's well away from a lot of the interference from the Milky Way. It gives us a nice, clean window on the distant universe. Hubble studied it. The James Webb Space Telescope have studied it. What is different about this is part of a 10-year project that's going to watch this patch of the sky change night after night, creating a cinematic record of the universe. It's going to return to the Rubin Observatory. It's going to return to the same region of sky roughly 800 times over the next decade, and we'll look at what has changed in incredible detail. I mean, you look at that image and you can just keep going and zooming. I mean, I think it's such a big image that often you have to kind of wait for the internet connection to catch up and for it to unpixelate a bit as it resolves that greater level of detail as you zoom in. And then just to get this again and again and again, 800 times over 10 years, it means you can see things change that we've just never seen change before. Asteroids moving through the solar system, stars exploding, things that might just happen over a short term that we don't notice when we just photograph a region of space every few years. I mean, it's exciting because it's one of these science... You know, sometimes you have these telescopes or you have these science missions and it's like, well, we want to try and discover X, or we want to try and test this particular idea. You know, we want to look for the Higgs boson in CERN. And some of those can be really exciting. But I think it's in some ways even more exciting where it's like, well, let's just look at something in a way we've never looked before and see what we find. And we just don't know. The full survey, which has already started, is going to map 20 billion galaxies and 17 billion stars. And you know, it's anticipated to find millions of new asteroids to help map out some of the invisible forces present in the universe, dark matter, dark energy. Again, I'm talking a lot about the morning brief email this morning, but Mr. Hilliker wrote about it in this morning brief, and he opened by quoting Psalm 36 and verse 5, "Your mercy, O Lord, is in the heavens." And that's what this is looking at. It's looking at the heavens, it's looking at the stars. I mean, in a very real sense, it is looking at God's mercy. And it's looking backwards in time because it takes a lot of time from those stars to reach us, but it's looking into the future. And it's looking into God's merciful plan for all mankind. God created all of that mind-numbing quantity of real estate for a purpose. And that purpose is our purpose. You know, it's bound right up with mankind. God plans to send mankind out there to plant the heavens. God has a name for every star. The Bible talks about that. And this is our future. This is what God is getting our attention for with wildfires and raising up this boiling pot, this cauldron of resentment in modern Europe, raising this up as a as a new European superpower that's going to punish Britain and America. Well, it's all about preparing Britain and America, preparing Europe, preparing Germany, preparing Russia and China, preparing the world to be used in planting the heavens and going out into what we see in this incredible picture. So it's great to be reminded of just the reason for all of these different news events with that photo release there. And we have our book, Your Awesome Universe Potential, that talks about what God has planned for you and for all the world out there among the stars. I mean, we've mentioned a few books on here. I'll point particularly to that one, and then also Why Natural Disasters, after talking about the wildfires, that shows why God even sends weather curses. You can get both of those on our website, thetrumpet.com. I mean, those two together will give you a wonderful picture of God's love, of God's purpose, of what God is doing behind the news in this world today. And that really is what this show is all about. We'd be very happy to send those to you. Any questions, any comments, you can get in touch with us at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you very much to all of our panelists. Thank you as well to Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. We'll be back next week. Until then, keep watching your world.